Anna Glavinsky on TRE in the afternoon.
Right now, I am joined on the line by Emiliana Vegas. I'm really looking forward to speaking to her about her book, Let's Change the World, How to Work Within International Development Organizations to Make an Actual Difference. Hello, Emiliana. How are you doing?
Hello, Anna. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, sorry for adding an extra word into the title. It doesn't say how to make an actual difference, but I get the impression that that is really the message that you're trying to drum home, because it seems to me that you know a lot about that industry. And am I right in saying that there are frustrations about the efficiency of it, or, you know, people go into it, into that sector with good intentions that don't necessarily work out as they imagine?
Correct. I think it's, you know, an industry that also over many years has gotten sort of a lot of bad press because some of the projects that have been funded haven't, you know, met the expectations in terms of the outcomes that they were intended to achieve. Sometimes they've been criticized for imposing views of sort of the more advanced economies into low and middle income countries. But I found over, you know, many years of working there that they also provide an amazing platform to really work with governments across sort of the low and middle income spectrum to help them achieve their goals, to help them, you know, in my case, implement education policies and programs that do help students progress and learn and get the skills they need to succeed. So, you know, you can see it both ways. And I tried to portray in this book an optimistic view, while not naive, of how you as a professional who cares about making a difference in the world can work through international development organizations and have that impact.
Absolutely. And you say in your case, could you just give us a little bit of a background about who you are and what you personally, with your experience, have been able to bring to this book?
Sure. So I am currently a professor of practice at the Harvard Graduate School of Education in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I've been at Harvard for 2 years as a professor, but I graduated from the doctoral program that I now am involved with. So I'm, it's kind of like homecoming for me. And after I graduated from Harvard, I went straight into the World Bank to work as a young professional in a program they call the Young Professionals Program, which is a highly selective program. They admit between 30 and 40 individuals under 32 years of age. You must have at least a master's degree and some years of experience in order to get in. And then they really provide you a lot of opportunities to get, you know, more skills, to develop professionally and to grow within the institution. So I worked there for 11 years, and then I had the opportunity to move as the head of the, or they call it the division chief for education at the Inter-American Development Bank, which is a regional bank focused on Latin America and Caribbean countries. And I was there for 7 years. And after that, I went to the Brookings Institution at their Center for Universal Education. And I worked there for as their co-director for a little over 2 years. And from there, I came to Harvard. So I've had kind of an experience across the board between, you know, large development institutions that provide a lot of resources to low and middle income countries, to think tanks like Brookings that receive, you know, grants from philanthropy and others to influence sort of the global debates in education. And now I'm delighted to be at Harvard, which also provides an incredible platform to influence and to train the next generation of leaders.
Wow, that really is a wealth of experience. I think people are very lucky to be able to tap into that. And I want to just pick up on something you said at the very beginning, where the international development sector, the work sector, has received some bad press in the media more recently. Could you just delve into that a little bit more? Give us some clear examples, you know, maybe some stories that people might remember, just to jog people's memories a little bit.
Yeah, in particular, I think there was this technocratic view in the 90s that governments needed to have sort of very balanced budgets in order to grow. And the World Bank works very closely with the International Monetary Fund. And between the two of them, they advised countries that were facing very deep, you know, debt situations or economic crises to sort of adopt reforms that would be very difficult. For example, to raise prices of subsidized goods like gas or foods. And the people in these countries really found it really harsh, and they protested, and they sort of labeled these policies as neoliberal. They actually led to the overthrow of several governments, including in my own country, Venezuela. So for many years, they were perceived, and to some extent, they still are, as institutions that impose really harsh policies that countries sometimes aren't ready to adopt, and that maybe there's a less of a consensus in how they provide the financing, so that they impose conditions, let's say, in their loans that governments need to accept because they're desperate to get funding.
Yeah.
And so that's been a troubled history of these institutions, I would say, over over many years. There is a reality that the banks have a lot of technocrats, a lot of, you know, PhDs, people who I would say care. And at the same time that countries, you know, often don't have policies that are conducive to development and growth and equity. And so there's a balance between to what extent do you push countries to change their policies and do the right things, and to what extent do you support, you know, what they want to do? And so there's always a trade-off there.
Yeah, exactly. Not just barging in and saying, you have to do it this way because we say so, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I think, I think over the years, at least, you know, and I would say, and I say that in my book too, that it's not like the banks have one way of working or the International Development Organization. It's really, they recruit really different kinds of people, and hopefully they recruit people who are going to work in a particular way. I like to say that, you know, I never felt like I was imposing an agenda. I was working very collaboratively with colleagues who were in government positions and who were in leadership positions outside of government in the countries that I was working in, to really get a sense of what were the challenges, what did they see as possible solutions, and then help them understand what had worked elsewhere outside of their own country, kind of give them more options that sometimes you can have if you've always lived and worked in a particular setting. And then we come up with some, you know, solutions that were both, you know, I would say globally informed, or, you know, where there was evidence that they had worked elsewhere, but then adapted to the local context. And then therefore they were more likely to be accepted and to work and achieve the intended impact.
Yeah. And I can hear from the way you're speaking, you're rightfully proud of the empathy that you and your colleagues and other people that you've worked with are approaching these issues, you know, trying to use practical solutions and, I suppose, human heart at the same time as well. Could you give us some stories, because at the end of the day, we all love stories, from your career where you really saw tangible change happen because of international development efforts, you know, to back up those thoughts and those ideas that you're saying here?
Yeah, I think one of the ones that I'm most proud of was when I was a fairly young professional myself, working for the education team in the Latin American region of the World Bank. And it was summer, August of, I believe, 2006. And we received a request from the Ministry of Finance of Chile to help provide technical assistance, so not funding, but mostly kind of research and evidence on how countries that had a large private sector funded by the public sector in education, how the governments could still ensure that schools, both private and public, were providing quality education for all. And it was a challenge because over many years of a nationwide school choice program in Chile, evidence had shown, and local researchers had shown, that that there was a lot of inequality in learning outcomes between students from low and high socioeconomic backgrounds. And so President Michelle Bachelet had sort of come to be really questioned around what was she doing. And she had announced the creation of a new institution to work alongside the Ministry of Education. That was the only sort of education at the national level institution called the Superintendency of Education. And so the Ministry of Finance and the Minister of Education both learned about this in the news, like everybody else. And they reached out and said, can you help us better understand how this institution would operate, what would be its role and responsibilities vis-a-vis the Ministry of Education. And I was charged with taking the lead on this, and I realized I didn't have any idea where to begin. Most of my training had been in economics of education or as an economist, and economists like to think of changes at the margins. How do you at the margin improve something? So, but not how do you, you know, reform an entire education system?
Wow. Yeah.
And so I reached out to my former Harvard advisor, who's has always been stayed in touch and been a great mentor and now friend. And he, you know, advised me to reach out to key leaders who had been involved in these kinds of reforms. And to my surprise, actually, one of them was Michael Barber, former chief of the delivery unit for the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, in the UK. And the other one was a former superintendent of schools in Seattle, in the state of Washington in the U.S., and both of them had been in different ways responsible for really introducing accountability with choice. And so I reached out of the blue. Like I said, I was fairly young. I was in my mid-30s, and both of them answered. And that's one thing that I want to highlight, is that the World Bank, you know, people do answer when the World Bank calls. It doesn't matter if you're in your 30s or you're the president of the bank. Like, they know you're going to have a good relationship with the government and that it's a channel to influence policy. And so both of them agreed to help me out and provided a lot of guidance into how to approach the problem, and then feedback as me and my team did most of the data collection and evaluation. And I'm part of this work because it actually led to a major reform that was approved by the Chilean parliament and that has been since implemented, which created the whole system, they call it, of quality assurance that works with the Ministry of Education. So there is a new superintendency and there's a new agency for education quality. And together with the Ministry of Education, they share the roles of policy setting, let's say evaluating and providing support to schools, and then also the superintendency in particular, holding schools accountable for the use of public funding. And it has led, among other reforms that Chile has done, to significant improvements over many years in terms of sort of reducing learning gaps between the rich and poor, moving the needle. So Chile has made significant improvements in the best known international assessment of student learning, the PISA exam that the OECD runs. And so, you know, as a fairly young person, it was a very nice way to see like how, you know, research, which I had been trained to conduct, and then working closely with the government and really listening to what they needed and how they needed it, and then seeing that turn into actually policies that are then rolled out and implemented and have impact.
Yeah, that's fantastic and massive as well. And you've worked with major organizations, yeah, like the World Bank, as you're mentioning, and Inter-American Development Bank. But what are the key differences, I suppose, between working with such large, well-respected, as you said, if you say that you're from the World Bank, you get answers from people to their emails straight away. How different is that between working in large organizations versus smaller NGOs, so, you know, non-governmental organizations?
You know, I think they all have a role to play. And I describe in my book that there are sort of five types, roughly speaking, of international development organizations. So they're large development banks. I group in the funders group. So they're organizations where, you know, the wealthier countries and the poorer countries actually provide resources, and then they own shares, and they also sit on their governing boards and help inform the policies and the loans and all of that. And so it's very, let's say, important in these organizations to have access to governments, but also to be accountable to governments. And then you have a second type of organization that also funds, but is very different in nature, which are the large private philanthropies and also some small ones. I sit on the board of a Swiss foundation called the Jacobs Foundation, whose mission is to improve learning among children around the world between 2 and 12 years of age, so really the younger children. And we fund a lot of research, we fund a lot of collaboration, and we also fund activities within countries to help move the needle in terms of how policies are grounded on evidence, you know. And like them, the Gates Foundation has been hugely influential in international development in multiple sectors. And then there's like other organizations that also play, you know, you mentioned civil society organizations, nonprofits. I tend to call them those types of organizations more depending on their function, so they can serve as advisors to governments or even to international organizations. They also can serve as implementers. So a lot of these organizations, like Save the Children or local NGOs, actually are very important in implementing programs and policies and working alongside governments to help bring sort of the intended, you know, funding to actually happen, right?
Yeah.
And then we have I would say another type of organization where I put Brookings in that category, but also the UN are organizations that actually convene all the major players, and then they get them to agree on things, or they set agendas that they're going to collaborate on. And so I think for people who are considering working in international development, like I did, you know, you have to kind of try a little bit of everything and figure out where is your best fit. You know, some people really love having boots on the ground and being in schools or in hospitals or in rural areas and seeing, you know, how the efforts really translate into direct impacts in people's lives. And that's super valuable because, you know, other people like me really enjoy the analytical process of thinking through how can I influence the decision makers and help them make better decisions that are grounded in evidence. And I've never really worked on, well, how does that then get implemented? But I know from my own research and from the experience I've had that that part is crucial. And so we need everybody, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. We need smart people, committed people in all of these types of organizations to make really, you know, to change the world.
Absolutely. And I feel like this chat could just go in any number of directions because you're really covering a huge breadth and depth, actually, in your book. There's so many things that we could talk about, but unfortunately, time won't allow it. So I'm just going to have to say to people that they have to get their hands on the book if they want to go into it a little bit deeper. But I would like you've spoken about how people getting into the international development industry should try out different things, find out where they feel like they fit. So I'd just like to ask, though, is there a final message you would like to share, particularly with youth or first step people who are looking to get into that industry that you know so much about? What message would you like to pass on?
I would say, you know, getting a really good education that provides you with analytical skills so that you know how to process, you know, a lot of information, make sense of it, and then provide recommendations. So that's a really important skill to work in this field, because a lot of the time we're just evaluating really difficult challenges from different perspectives and trying to figure out what should the government with support of these institutions do. And then secondly, I think, you know, understanding that while we have many differences, we all have the same aspirations. You know, every individual wants to have a healthy, productive, you know, safe life and be able to thrive. And that's what we want for ourselves and for our children. And yet we have so many differences across cultures. So being able to, you know, really work with different people with different cultures, recognizing that, you know, in the core, we're very similar and we share the same aspirations. I think those two aspects would make you, you know, a really good fit for this career path.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. That's all we've got time for. So I'm going to have to wrap it up there. But we've just been speaking to Emiliana Vegas. Her book is called Let's Change the World, How to Work Within International Development Organizations to Make a Difference. You can find it on the Talk Radio Europe bookshop on Amazon, or pop it into Google to see if you can find it in any bookshops near you. Emiliana, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Have a lovely day. Goodbye.
Bye.